Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Feel off? Tired? Moody? You might be missing minerals because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to traceminerals.com and feel the difference minerals make.
The Doors, of course, and Light My Fire. If you think you know the story of Jim Morrison and the Doors, a new book, Love Become a Funeral Pyre, biography of the Doors, from the critically acclaimed rock journalist Mick Wall, will make you think again. If you think you know who wrote all their hits, how Jim Morrison died, if you think you knew why Morrison fled to Paris never to return, with the book Love Becomes a Funeral Pyre, one of the legendary rock band The Doors and their iconic frontman Jim Morrison, Mick Wall, one of the most revered music writers and one of the last journalists to interview Ray Manzarek, has really set the cats amongst the pigeons. He sort of stripped back the myth, the legend behind the Doors, and I'm delighted and really excited to bring onto the line today, live from the UK, Mick Wall. Mick, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Charles.
Now then, there is no band in the history, I think, of rock and roll. There's such a mythology behind it, but such an amount of, some would call it bullwats it, some would call it legend status. You know, Morrison the poet, Morrison the preacher, Morrison. There's just so much. What drew you to begin with to look at the Doors again?
Well, because, you know, the irony about the Doors is that there are tons of books out there, DVDs, there's the Oliver Stone movie, a million articles. But the fact of the matter is they've all kind of built up this fairy story about Jim Morrison and his so-called mysterious death. And it really just has overlooked all the facts and spent all the time building the myth as opposed to saying what actually went on, what really went on. And when I first interviewed the three remaining members of the band, it became clear to me that particularly Ray, bless him, was as wrapped up in this fairy story as everybody else, and I just found it baffling. So I decided to look into it, and the more I started to look, the more amazed I became with what I found.
I mean, people going about, you know, you can't fault the first couple of albums, you know, with the Doors, but towards the end of the progression, it was a very short progression with the Doors, you know, in a couple of, you know, 5 to 6 years. Live they become a shambles.
They really had, and the blame for that, of course, has to be laid at Jim's feet. I mean, I think before you do make that statement, though, you also have to acknowledge the fact that without Jim Morrison, the other three guys would probably never have made it, certainly not on the huge international legendary level that they did. Morrison was a fantastic, charismatic, sexy, utterly compelling frontman at a time when the rules hadn't been written, the maps hadn't been drawn. Morrison, you know, wrote those rules and drew those maps for the great frontmen that followed in the 70s and 80s. But by the time you get to the end of the Doors' career in the late 60s, he'd become such an accident waiting to happen that, you know, he was inciting crowds to riots. The band were effectively blacklisted on the American concert circuit for over a year. They couldn't work. And again, I emphasize, this is the 60s when pop groups weren't expected to have a career beyond a year or two, and the rest of the guys in the band absolutely were in fear for their careers, their livelihoods. No one knew then what we know now. It really was uncharted territory, and Jim seemed absolutely intent intent on burning the whole church down.
Right, and the other thing was, of course, Jim was on this, you know, he wasn't a pop star. He couldn't be packaged nicely. I mean, he was thinking of himself as a poet. As you said, they had been, you know, sort of effectively blacklisted in America. So, you know, he upsticked and went to Paris.
Well, excuse me, sorry, he did up sticks and go to Paris, but, you know, the orthodox story is that that was a kind of act of defiance. I'm washing my hands of this silly boys rock and roll thing. The reality is that the other three members of the band had sacked him at that point. They had told him point blank they would never take the stage with him again. They were already making another album without him when he left for Paris. The reason he actually left for Paris was he was looking down the barrel of a jail stretch at Rayford Prison in Florida, then known as the most notoriously hard prison in America. And he was in fear for his life. He ran to Paris because he was advised that a lot of Vietnam draft dodgers went there because there was no extradition treaty between Paris and the France and the U.S. And he was a very tragic, lonely, confused, pitiful figure by the time we find him in Paris.
I mean, he'd gone to Paris because of this thing with was it profanity or public exposure? It was the.
Well, the public exposure in Miami, he was facing four criminal charges, all of which could have put him inside. In the end, he was found guilty of two of them and sentenced to jail. His lawyers managed to eke out, you know, they tried to challenge that. So they were drawing the whole thing out. But the fact is, he was going to jail. Mm. And there was no way Jim Morrison, rock god, long hair, pretty boy, was going to do that and survive it. So Jim did what any scared, witless person would do and fled.
And obviously the band, as you said, the band didn't support him. I mean, they carried on with their own albums. In fact, and bought out two albums after Morrison's death, which were totally underwhelming and proved the point that Morrison was actually, you know, the frontman par excellence.
Absolutely. I mean, it seems extraordinary now that they would even think they had a chance. But again, you have to remember the era we're talking about. The late 60s saw the breakup of the Beatles. It saw Jimi Hendrix break up his own band. It saw Cream break up. And in each instance, you know, Eric Clapton went on to have extraordinary success. The Beatles all had wonderful solo careers. Jimi Hendrix, didn't matter who he put on stage with him, he was always going to be a star. Bands broke up. Jeff Beck and Rod Stewart broke up, and Rod Stewart came back and had a great career with the Faces. This was a melting pot. This was a time when Janis Joplin could drop her backing band and still go on and be a star. They genuinely thought they had a chance. And of course, another thing that they maintained over the years was that they never dreamt of replacing Jim. Well, I interviewed two people in the book that were auditioned for the Doors and were very much lined up to be his replacement, plus two or three others that didn't audition because they weren't interested in the gig. The Doors were considered to be past their sell-by date at that point. So, you know, the reality just does not match the story that's now, you know, imbued on our cultural brains, and of course right up to the so-called death in the bathtub, which didn't happen either.
Right, now this is the controversial one, because I mean, everybody knows it's open folklore. You know, he goes to Paris, he hangs around with arty types, he's doing a bit of the brown stuff, and then he has a heart attack in a bathroom in Paris.
Yeah, it's just not true. I mean, it's a nice story. It ties up a lot of loose ends. But as you well know, life is not about nicely tied up loose ends. Life is always about terribly unresolved, tragic incidents. And Morrison's death was one of those. In a nutshell, his girlfriend, Pamela Courson, had been a serious heroin addict for a couple of years by that point. They were in Paris, and she was getting Jim to buy heroin for her on an almost daily basis. They had ounces of it in the flat in Paris. Paris. Morrison was actually at a nightclub, the Rock and Roll Circus, the night he died, and he actually bought more heroin there that he was going to take back to Pam. He'd also been begun using it on a regular basis. But two contributory factors come into play here. Number one, that summer in Paris, as immortalized in the movie French Connection, there was this huge new wave of heroin that came from Asia that was brown. It wasn't white as it used to be. And it was double the strength and half the price. And there were many, many fatalities right across Paris and Marseille that summer from people using heroin that they didn't realize was as strong as it was. The other contributing factor was that Jim was an alcoholic by the end of his life. And, you know, if you want to kill yourself, there's almost no more effective way than taking a load of really strong heroin on the night you're drunk out of your mind. And that's what happened to Jim. And he was found dead in a cubicle of the ladies' toilets at the Rock and Roll Circus. And I have two people I interviewed for the book as eyewitnesses that were there and told me exactly what happened. The bathtub story came about because they wanted to avoid the scandal at the club. The club was known for its underworld connections, its jet set connections. It didn't want to spoil the party. So his body was taken back to the apartment, undressed, placed in the bathtub, really hot water put into the bathtub to delay rigor mortis and disguise the time of death. And Pam, who was more terrified of the fact that if the police would arrive and find all this heroin in the apartment, was given 3 hours to clear the place up and stick to the story she was given to tell the cops when they were finally called about 3 hours after Morrison's death.
Right, and as I said, you've spoken to two people who were at the club and knew this then.
Yes, absolutely. One was the club owner, Sam Burnett, who has over recent years, you know, begun to tell his story very frankly. He did write his own memoir in French. It's never been translated into English. And another guy who was a Vietnam war photographer who was also working, just was a young guy at the time, working for some cash at the Rock and Roll Circus. He actually helped remove the body from the cubicle. People say to me, but hey, you know, the French police, surely blah, blah, blah. The French police, particularly in the early 1970s, you know, were notorious for being, shall we say, having a laissez-faire attitude to the crimes they chose to solve and the ones they thought weren't worth the candle. Jim Morrison was not a huge star in France anymore. As far as they knew, he was a bum, he was a hippie, he wasn't French, he wasn't important. They knew what had happened, it was obvious. But far better to let him and his junkie girlfriend go back to America and just close the case. What was there to solve? The guy had died of an overdose.
Right. I mean, he used to boast that, you know, Jimmy was dead, that Janice was dead, and you know, you were drinking with number three.
Yeah, he used to say that, but then, you know, Jim was an incredibly self-aggrandizing person. He concentrated for most of his life on building up this mythical persona, you know, to hide the fact, as so many of these guys do, the fact that he was insecure, he was nervous. He'd been a serial bedwetter as a child. He had mother issues because his own mother was so cruel to him. He had father issues because his father was an admiral in the U.S. Navy. And as Jim was singing about, you know, the unknown soldier, his father was actually helping drop bombs on Vietnam. You know, he was a very conflicted, confused person who found it not only delightfully delicious, but also essential to his own sanity or his own escape from that reality, to build up this persona where he's the lizard king, he can do anything. In fact, by the end of his life, he's an overweight, overwrought guy without a gig, girlfriend's a junkie, and he's, you know, hundreds and thousands of miles from home with no prospect of going back anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, if, and of course, it was in the Doors' best interest to keep this story going because it sold more albums, of course, and Pamela wouldn't survive much longer than after Jim had died anyway.
No, Pamela was dead within a couple of years of a heroin overdose. The Doors, in fact, were largely forgotten by the mid-70s. It was only really the American Prayer album, which the three remaining Doors, to their credit, you know, built an album around Jim's audio recordings of some of his poems, some old Doors tracks, some live tracks, and they built some new music around it, a kind of a funk rock, jazz rock thing that was very contemporary for the late 70s. And it single-handedly brought the Jim Morrison story back into focus. And from there, it built up to the point where, you know, the Doors right now in 2015 sell more records, more merchandise, more of everything branded the Doors than they ever did in the few years they were actually active with Jim.
I mean, do you think, I mean, the fact that Ray Manzarek, you know, tried to tell you that, you know, Jim was still alive, he'd slipped away and he was now living in idyllic comfort writing poetry, do you think that was just part of the whole, was a cynical attempt, with, you know, just to keep the merchandising or keep the band alive?
I don't think Ray Manzarek had a cynical bone in his body. I think that, you know, as we get older, you know, we tell ourselves the story of our lives. We build up a narrative inside our heads. Whoever we are and whatever we've done, we find a way to explain it. And in his case, it was a very extraordinary life, a very extraordinary situation where, because Jim had grown pathetic and ill and finally died, the Doors became immortal. If Jim hadn't died, if he'd gone on to a so-so kind of solo career, the Doors had continued with some patchy work with another singer, none of these things would have happened. But he died, there was a legend, and for a brief while in the 70s, I think there was a genuine thought that perhaps he was still alive. But the fact of the matter is the feeling I got the last time I spoke to Ray just a few months before he died, he actually said to me at that point, he was telling me that he thought Jim could have been the president of America. He was telling me that, you know, he wouldn't be surprised tomorrow if he got a postcard from Jim saying, hey, I'm in, you know, Hawaii or something like that. And I'm thinking, Jim could never have been the president of the United States. And B, who sends postcards these days? It would be a text. It would be a tweet. And God bless him, but Jim's dead. And I couldn't crush Ray's thing because he was an older guy by the time I caught up with him. And this was the story he had been telling, you know, for over 40 years, and telling himself this story. Mm. And that story made all of them millionaires, far more than the work they did while Jim was alive.
Something tells me that you must have seen the Oliver Stone film when it came out 20 years ago, through sort of, you know, from behind the sofa kind of thing, because that absolutely vamps the lizard up, the legend up, doesn't it, of the lizard?
It does. I remember seeing it at the time and actually leaving before the end because I found it just tediously two-dimensional. I think if I'd known nothing about the Doors, it would have been an entertaining movie. But, you know, I've worked inside the music business, not just as a writer, but as in management for record companies, in PR. And I know, you know, what it's like to work with rock bands. I know the reality. I've worked with pretty much every major rock star you could name. And none of them, not even Jim Morrison, are like Oliver Stone depicted him in that movie.
What do you think then, you know, the Doors' legacy is and Morrison's legacy? You said that he wrote the rule book on how a rock star, or at least, you know, I mean, he was the sexiest, he was once, wasn't the face of once called him the sexiest dead man alive. You know, he really did write the rule book as it comes to rock sex god. And also, no man before or since has ever looked that good in leather trousers, you have to admit.
Absolutely. I mean, while that candle burned, you know, it burned from both ends, but it burned exceedingly brightly. Jim's own hero was Elvis Presley. He was obsessed with Elvis and Frank Sinatra, who at that point, before Jim, were the two biggest singing stars in the world. And Jim, you know, his whole aim, his whole being was to be that supernova star. And he achieved it. He achieved it almost too easily, so that by the time those first two Doors albums had appeared and he was considered as big a pop star as the Monkees, he was already railing against it. It was not good enough. He was already saying at the age of 24, I want to be taken seriously. I want to be immortal. I want to do something that changes the world. He used to refer to Doors concerts as his church, and he referred to the fans as being members of his religion. And again, you know, think back to the mid to late 60s, you know, at the time when John Lennon was pilloried for saying the Beatles were bigger than Jesus Christ, Jim Morrison thought he was Jesus Christ.
Absolutely. If people want to find out a little bit more about yourself, do you Facebook? I mean, are you waiting for your tweet from Jim Morrison in Hawaii?
I have my own website, mickwall.com. I have an official Facebook page. I tweet, as we all do these days. I'm there. I'm online. I'm very happy to hear from everybody.
Super. The book's called Love Become a Funeral Pyre, a biography of the Doors. It's out. Who's publishing it, by the way? It hasn't crossed my radar on that one.
In the UK and Europe, it's Orion. In America, it's Chicago Review Press. Fantastic company. Both Orion and Chicago Review are fantastic people. I'm just really fortunate to have such great people behind me that they allowed me to go out on a limb with this book and really try and tell it for the first time.
That's yeah, absolutely. And we're very fortunate to have you with us. Just before you go, Mick, I've got to ask this question, because you bumped into, is it true that you bumped into John Peel in the corridors of Radio 1 and he showed you how to operate the coffee machine?
Yes, I mean, we had actually, bizarre as it seems now, in the late 70s, when I was 19, I started writing for Sounds magazine, long gone.
Oh, blimey, I remember that, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Big Music Weekly in the late 70s, and John used to do a regular column for the magazine, and of course, no internet, you had to bring in your typewritten story on paper and deliver it, and so I used to, you know, say hi, and very much the junior member taking the copy off him and thinking, that's John Peel, you know. But then later when I did some radio things at the Beeb, he was there. And yes, he was. The thing about John Peel was he was wonderful to new bands. Brilliant. You know, all those bands we now think of and we say John was the first one that played them. But off air, he was also brilliant to everybody he came across that needed a hand, needed a word of encouragement, just people that you know, weren't famous but just trying to make their way. John was always exceedingly friendly and accommodating and very inspirational in that respect.
The book is called Love Becomes a Funeral Pyre, a biography of the Doors. Mick Wall, it has been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to speak to you today.
It's been brilliant to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Have a great weekend.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in three delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals, and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at TraceMinerals.com.